March 12, 2021, it's the Wild for Pedro Show.
Thank you.
For Pedro Show. Happy Friday. Started with John Coltrane live in Birdland in 1963 doing Alabama. And then Presidential Love Theme from Tom Borax. Brother Matt, well, you might have heard something there, people. Brother Matt's at the Love Grotto Pleasure Point a couple miles south because we're still quick quarantino mode. But I am not totally man alone because those Skype Estonian software engineers with their Skype invention. I got all the way from Baltimore, Tom Borax. Welcome aboard, Tom.
Thank you.
Yeah. And, you know, people, listeners, I was talking a little bit, telling Tom, man, there's something going on in Baltimore. There's people making some wild music, him and Dor, you know. So I want to learn about your journey through music, Tom, please. Your earliest musical recollection.
Yeah, I'm going to talk to you about these recollections, but I will answer your question first. My earliest musical recollection is, my dad is a musician. He's a music teacher and stuff. So it's kind of hard for me to really, it might be a little hard for me to place that, but, it's been in my house and in my life, I think always. So I think that's what makes it so vague, but he had a big record collection and a lot of instruments, including a grand piano in the house. So I think that my most formative things is I just remember really like listening to Top 40 and being really into it, you know, at a really young age, like kindergarten, you know, where I would like tune it in and listen to it. So I remember Casey Kasem in that, clearly, being, you know, like a kindergartner, a first grader.
And where was this?
This is in Baltimore. I'm a native.
Okay. Wow. Cause a lot of cats I've talked to there, then you might know where I first played as a Minuteman, your town. It was a place called the Marble Bar.
Heck yeah, of course, absolutely.
It's kind of a heavy neighborhood.
Now, I have to say, I'm a little bit younger, so the Marble Bar was a ruin when I was active in the music scene. But
it was kind of a ruin then, too.
the building is there, and you can see the Marble Bar. And in fact, I have a feeling that if I was, you know, daring enough, I could maybe spelunk into the Marble Bar, but I never went to the place.
Okay, because everybody else I talk to, it's before their time, but you know in there. And maybe you couldn't get in because, drinking age and shit like that. But now that piano you remember, and you remember it's a Watt from Pedro show, so there's no hard questions, there's no wrong answers. Mm-hmm. That piano, did you jump on it?
No, I don't think I did anything abusive to that piano. although I must say that the piano is in my house now, the house that I live in, and I have been abusive to it as an adult because it's a piece of crap.
No, I may jump on it like you know, you initiated trying to play it, or were you like forced to take lessons?
I played it before I was forced to take lessons. I did not do great with the lessons, but my dad tried to teach me to read and write music because I remember having this idea when I was maybe like 6 or 7 that I was going to compose. I remember writing this song because he taught me how to write the notation and the values of the notes. And I remember writing a song, and it was like this little melody that maybe lasted like 3 bars, and then the rest of the whole page was like the finale, and it all, you know, and it was like, it was almost like this like Wagnerian, like Sturm und Drang, you know, like big drawn out ending.
But still, yeah. I mean, at 6 or 7, that's pretty fucking good. What about at school? Were you in the choir, the marching band, and shit like that?
All of the above. I play trombone, and then when I was in high school, I was, you know, into guitar, so I became a jazz aficionado, and I was the guitarist in the jazz band in high school. But at a younger age, I was in the church choirs, Catholic. There's a lot of Catholic stuff in Baltimore. So I sang in the church choir, and I played trombone in a sort of late elementary school, kind of middle school setting. Yeah.
Bass clef.
Yes.
And I understand from my friends who had to do the marching band shit, the big mouthpiece made it a lot easier than working trumpet or French horn.
Yeah, I can't do those. I can't do those. My dad was a French horn player in like classical setting.
Oh, wow. John Entwistle, the bass man, Pictures of Lily, has a fucking French horn solo in the middle by him.
Really?
I wouldn't shit you, Damn. Tom.
I mean, I listen to Picture of Lily a lot. I'm trying to imagine French horn in that. That's a wonderful song.
In the middle of it, listen to it again. There's a French horn.
Okay.
I mean, there ain't a lot of rock songs with fucking French horn songs.
Yeah.
But that one's in there, and it's from Mr. Entwistle. And I used that song to write my very own Piss Bottle Man, if you want a little tangent there. So what about the first record you bought with your own money, Tom?
I can tell you this one with confidence. It's the same time span. It's like I was maybe 5 years old or 6 years old. And this might sound like I'm boasting, but it was actually Let There Be Rock by AC/DC.
That's a good one.
Yeah. And it was at Kmart. And I think it was $4.
What about the first gig you went and saw?
I mean, maybe I saw hardcore shows and stuff at a pretty young age, like 13 or 14, but I can't remember. Maybe that was like in a church basement or something, but I saw Rush.
Okay.
I saw Rush play in Baltimore at age 14.
I've seen Rush twice and I conked at both gigs and they were like 30, almost 40 years apart.
Whoa. Yeah. No, I mean, they're pretty sick dudes.
I got to meet a couple of them because,
Les
Claypool was real in that. Opened up for Primus in Toronto. They were very nice guys, and they all know how to play and stuff. What about, you said you got into guitar. How did you get your first guitar? Was it a gift?
No, it wasn't. You know, my dad, I told you he was a French horn player, but he actually, to make cash, because he didn't want to stay in the classical scene because I think it was too competitive for him and he lost his appetite for it. So he was like a high school teacher and he learned every instrument.
Yeah, I was going to say, usually music teachers can play a little bit of everything, right?
Yeah, and so I think that he just went berserk in the early 70s and decided he wanted to start this like blood, sweat, and tears / Chicago Transit Authority type band. And he like, you know, he would like play guitar, rhythm guitar, and then he would reach up and grab a trumpet or, you know, he played all the things. So he had a Les Paul because he played in this, you know, like cover band that started out as a Blood, Sweat, and Tears band. And he had a Les Paul in the basement. So when I was 14 and I was like, I want to play electric guitar, he just, you know, blew the dust off this Les Paul and basically it was mine.
Ah, oh, so a donate.
Yeah. That's yeah.
A, you know what? The guitar man would whip out the trumpet and shit. Was Dick Dale. Dick Dale.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
That's not him playing trumpet on Miser Lou, is it?
Yeah, I think it is. And he what? I know that gigs he did that.
Oh, man. That guy's, yeah.
Kind of all around.
Tremendous. And he's Lebanese, too. I knew that.
Yeah. His ethnicity. And, you know, the trumpet, there's something about it because, especially a lead guitar, it's kind of monophonic, you know?
Mm-hmm.
So Ennio Morricone, you know, he was a trumpet man, and you hear him using the surf guitar in his compositions. Here, mm-hmm. I want to play something from you. Doug's username on eBay, Spaghetti mm-hmm. Van Halen. There's two.
Jabbers. Shot are the Boneyard guys.
Oh, havoc really bad.
You want me to do it? Alright, I'll button down.
I was on Reddit. The area is very.
Thank you.
Swap for Pedro show. Yeah, that was snacks. So, well, we're going to get to this, but this is an early proj of Tom Barnax. It's Doug's username on eBay, Spaghetti Van Halen. Then we had Network Glass with NF. There's Door. Tobacco.
Yeah, that's Door.
Right. Tobacco with Full of Doom. Brand new. Mr. Tom out of Pittsburgh's got a new album called Fucked Up Friends, number 3. Barry Berko Band after that, Until When. Bombas Prendon, Chicken Scratch Fanfare. These guys been around for about 40 years, recorded like 5,000-6,000 songs, did 5 gigs. M.B. Jones out of Pusan with Dinosaurs. And finally, Leprechaun Catering. We're going to hear a lot of Leprechaun Catering, people. Gorgeous asshole. Now, you know the thing? Now, you got a guitar, so you must have got an amp, too, seeing it being a Les Paul. What about the... Now, I'm not saying after school, like you graduated, but like after school in the afternoon, did you do the bedroom band, the garage band, the basement band with friends?
Yeah. Yeah, I did. High school was the time. And it was, my parents left Baltimore. So I was in a rural place at the time. And it was very, I guess it was very thrash metal oriented at this time. I think, this is like, the mid to late 80s period, and it was hard to find anybody interested in anything other than that out in the rural areas. But I did eventually kind of start a art punk band when I was in high school.
Now, were you like when you were 5 or 6 and composing, or were you guys copying stuff off people's records?
No, it was pretty original. I mean, I don't want to sound like an ass, but yeah, I was sort of into this idea of being, like a visionary, like tuning all my strings so they were floppy and, stuff like that.
Okay. That's why you said art rock. Okay. Mm-hmm. Okay. And did this band have a name?
This was The Lawnmowers.
The Lawnmowers. And did The Lawnmowers, was it just practice or did you guys do gigs?
We recorded, but we didn't do gigs. So we were kind of like, we were kind of like the post Sergeant Pepper, post Sergeant Pepper phase, but we never had a pre Sergeant Pepper phase. We just recorded recorded 4-track songs.
So you have recordings of this long?
Yeah. Course. Yeah,
wow,
I do.
You should have flown me some. Okay. Okay. So it seems like at some point you let go of the guitar and get into electronics.
Yeah.
Now, do you pursue music after high school? Do you go to like a college, music college?
No, everybody thought that I was going to go to a music school, and I ended up being a poetry major, and I dropped out after 2 years and just went berserk. And I actually have a master's degree now, but I was out of school for, I was out of school for 17 or 18 years after I dropped out, and I just did stuff.
You know who was two guys ran away to New York City to be poets, and they started a band called Television. Richard Hell and Tom Verlaine.
Verlaine, yeah. That's a good one.
Yeah. Season of Hell, right? The Rimbaud Verlaine thing. So, look, poetry's pretty musical.
It is. It is.
I could see
I just
that.
Got back into it. Yeah. After I dropped out of that, when I told you, I kind of turned my back on poetry, and last year I've been poetry nut.
Okay, okay. See, life comes in cycles, right?
It
That's
does.
All right. We take turns. But you do let go of the guitar, right?
Yeah, yeah. I got a few still, but they don't meet with my fingers too much these days.
Like this music that you flowed me for the show today, it seems a lot of electronic.
It is.
So when did that? I'm trying to find out when that came about with you in your journey.
Yeah, yeah. I'll try to make this short, but I got into a community here that was doing a lot of improvised and experimental music in the mid 90s, and I was playing only guitar at the time, and I saw two shows. One of them was this guy named Jim Baker in Chicago, who's still around. He's amazing. And he is a virtuoso jazz pianist, even plays with Ken Vandermark and those kind of guys since that time period. But he has had an ARP 2600 synthesizer, And I just had never seen anything like that before. But he was playing it in this almost like jazz way, or like free jazz, you know? And just seeing him kind of wrangling it, it totally cooked my brain. I was into club music and house music, because I used to go to all the sort of techno and raves and club things in Baltimore at the time, but I didn't really know how to get into it or what it was. And then I was so into experimental music that I just assumed that my clubbing was like kind of just, you know, some other thing, and that my interest in electronics was never going to come over into the improvisation world. And then I just, when I saw Jim, I was like, that's it. I'm going to be like a, you know, a crazy, like free jazz jammer on synthesizer. And that was it.
So you went and bought a synthesizer.
Yeah. I worked my way towards it. And eventually, I guess around 2000, I started like soldering kits and building and making like a, you know, modular synthesizers.
You think one of the gateway drugs was maybe stomp boxes for the guitar?
A little bit, but because I was so into jazz that I had this idea that I was going to do everything just with my fingers. So, you know, as recently as like 1998 on guitar, I would just put a pickup into an acoustic guitar, and like that was it. Even though I was playing really aggressive music, my whole theory was that if I can't just do it with my fingers, then, you know, I mean, that's a very naive thing, and I've gone so far past that since then. But that was my feeling back then, was, you know, that it was going to be like, and just like a saxophone, but a guitar or something.
Okay. Now, because, you know, electronic music like Mr. Baker and stuff, and Wendy Carlos and Mort Sobotnik, mm-hmm. Carl Hayden Stockhouse, and that these people, they were actual electronic devices. They weren't part of pewters. And you're talking about 2000s. So what were you thinking? Maybe I get a pewter that has plugins, or do I get machines like these guys and work them like guitars?
Yeah, that was it. I mean, the Leprechaun Catering, my accomplice, Jason Willett, and I just, all of our early albums, I mean, I think I don't think there's computers in any of our music, even to this day. I mean, we nowadays, in the last 10 years, we've been doing a lot of editing with computers, you know, of our jams. But our performances are never computer.
Okay, what was now I'm curious, your first synthesizer. You made it? You built it yourself?
Yes, I did. It was like from kits. You probably even know these like Paya synth kits. They've been around since the 80s.
Yeah,
they're junk.
or learning.
I mean, they're great. They're wonderful, actually.
Kind of learning devices or some. Yeah.
Yeah.
No. Here's another trip about the older days. We're going to make an artificial keyboard. But then the real electronic musicians, no, these are their own instruments. These are not fake keyboards or string sections or organs. Mm-hmm. In fact, when I first saw Peru, Alan Ravenstein, mm-hmm. he had no keyboard. It was just two boxes with knobs and patch cords.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
What's your take?
Yeah, I mean, I eventually did get a Korg Monopoly, and I just saw the other day that Behringer reissued it, or they built a Monopoly, or like people can actually like buy this weird like new Monopoly. But I bought one of those around 2002, and that was a good one. And I liked the keyboard on it, because I'm such a piano person. Like, I have a harpsichord now, and I play harpsichord all the time. I think I sent you a harpsichord song in there, but
I thought that's what that was.
Yeah, I mean, I still play keyboards a lot, but there's a book called Analog Days. It's sort of about Moog and Buchla. And apparently, like, Vladimir Ushishevsky, I think I'm saying that correctly, he was always, you know, getting on Moog about, like, well, why do you want to do the keyboard? And, like, you know, like, this is a whole new instrument. You don't need to put a keyboard on it. And I think that that he, and eventually Moog was, you know, kind of getting convinced by that. He was like, I guess they're right, you know? And then I think that Moog changed his mind and he was like, it's just a trigger. You know, like the keyboard is just a map. And
absolutely.
In the synth, it could just be whatever you want it to be. And even though I don't have a keyboard on my synth nowadays, I think like a keyboardist, and I like the keyboard. I think the keyboard is perfect. You know, it's
the right thing.
You
got pioneer people, they get kind of purist a little bit. So maybe that's what was. Look, we're at the end of the first hour, March 12th, 2021. Dishwap Pedro Show special guest, Tom Borax. Hold tight for hour two. March 12th, 2021. It's the second hour of the Watt from Pedro Show. We'll be right back. mistakes. Have you got what it takes?
Thank you.
Pedro Show start off the second hour with Barbaric Sports from Leprechaun Catering. Ben Salter with Warren Mason doing Mistakes. And Clara Rockmore with Midnight Bells. Now, she's a protege of the Theremin Cat. Mm-hmm. See, you're talking triggers, right? And mm-hmm. Theremin's all about the trigger.
Yeah.
It's a proximity thing, right? Proximity.
Yeah, I've had quite a few of those over the years.
Using hand capacitance. Now, I was, we were talking about, you know, the keyboard and the synthesizer mm-hmm. in this weird kind of relationship. But are you aware of this lady, the doctor, she performed the Doctor Who theme, Darby,
Delia Derbyshire?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. She, one reason she quit electronic music was because of the synthesizers. She said everybody should be cutting on tape and shit. Why are we using these?
Yeah, there was a lot of resentment in the radiophonic workshop about the synthesizer.
Yeah.
They thought it was really abrasive.
Yeah, and kind of like trying to do some shortcut on the electronic truth.
Mm-hmm.
Which meant, you know, more like clay, right? And you don't know until you throw it on the wheel and start sculpting, right? And it was too set in the ways. And to me, it's all very provocative and interesting, and it's just inspiring. You know, these are all ways to channel human expression, right? And the stuff we can share. Tell me about how you mentioned your Leprechaun Catering, and it was a duet.
It's a duo, yeah. It was a trio when we had for maybe 3 years. I mean, Jason and I have been playing together for 20 years.
Yeah, well, tell me about the whole trip. How did Leprechaun Catering get going?
Well, Jason is Jason's great. He's a really interesting guy. He runs a record shop out of Baltimore, and he's been doing that for about 13 or 14 years. And he's also the bass player in Half Japanese. The current iteration of Half Japanese. It was one of those things where he lived in a warehouse in Baltimore all through the 90s, and he was so eccentric that he like never left. And, he like never left his place. And all the people that I knew that are starting to, you know, kind of introduce me into the community and, making like experimental music and noise music. Everybody who met me, because I was trying to be as eccentric as I could. So I'd always, you know, I was smoking a pipe everywhere I went, and like, you know, always wearing like, you know, pointy toed shoes and like all this stuff and ties and whatever. And everybody who met me and like my aesthetic, everybody was like, you got to meet Jason. And it was kind of annoying to me because I was like, I don't want to have like some other eccentric, you know, guy that I'm like competing with. And I think people were saying it to Jason too. And when eventually we did meet, I think that we were both kind of just scoping each other out in this like antagonistic way. And then I went to India for about 6 months. And when I got back from India, I needed a place to live, and Jason was staying in the house that I moved into, and we just started playing Leprechaun Catering from that point forward, and that was it.
Who came up with the name?
I am going to tell you exactly who came up with the name. His name is Rupert Wondolowski, and he's a poet in Baltimore, and he also runs a record store and a bookstore.
Of course.
Uh-huh.
Okay. And what did he say? Tom, I know a name for your band.
No, I actually worked as a chef for a long time, and people started paying me to cater stuff, and Rupert, he does this voice when he calls people, and he left this message on my machine at the time. It was like, Mr. Borax, I need you to do a Leprechaun Catering gig for me. And that was it. I thought that was funny, and that's the name.
Yeah, okay. Lucky charms. Here, I want to play, I like the title of this, Military Blunder.
Mm-hmm.
There's a big history, Clipper ships, Fells Point, right?
Yeah.
far too long. The water is rising, soon this will all be gone. My mother taught me how to swim when I was still young. I don't think that that'll help me, but I ain't gonna run. I'm burning my belongings just to keep warm. But this goddamn ring doing me wrong. Stuff is all but gone. What did I do wrong? It's gone. I am the last of my name. Everything that I once loved has been lost to the flames. And no man can make me leave this place. I dare God to try. Sometimes you've gotta stand where you're willing to doused by the rain, soaked to the bones, but I feel no pain. So let the water come down, let it do its worst. I was born of this land, I will return to its stern.
Live from Pedro Show. Leprechaun Catering with Military Blunder. Hatchet Field, Northern Ireland. Leave the water home. Leave the water come. Then Tommy Gayhill at Alaska with Tamneo. Yes. Yeah, this is Gaelic. I slaughter another language, people. I'm sorry. And finally, Leprechaun Catering. Bad guys redeem without reconciliation. So, what was the first Leprechaun Catering gig like?
I don't think we really learned we hadn't really gained our shtick at the time. And so it was probably a struggle. I think it took us a little while to get something really going. I know we did one gig, really early on where, Jason had a stylophone. You know those things?
Sure.
Yeah. He had a stylophone record. And I think it's this guy who's a famous Australian rock star named Rolf Harris. And like Rolf is giving the instructions of how to play the stylophone. And I played sitar because I studied sitar when I was in India and I'd just gotten back from India. And I think we did a gig where we played along with like Somewhere Over the Rainbow and like Brazil and all these, you know, sort of 60s kind of stylophone, easy listening songs. And we played along with the record. So we brought a turntable to the gig and I played all the melodies on sitar and he played he doubled the melodies on stylophone.
Well, you said something about you guys starting as a trio.
The trio was in the middle and that was with a drummer named Dan Breen. Yeah.
Okay. So did you probably had the shtick by then, but then the shtick changed.
The shtick changed.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And,
yeah.
When you guys get together, do you compose?
Never.
Collab?
Never.
Okay.
So no, it's totally free form. The composing comes in the editing.
Okay.
Because we've always had lots of samplers and stuff, and before computers, we would just sample our jams. We would sample ourselves and then order it around and just kind of, you know, place things in certain spots and then occasionally pull out stuff, you know, or an occasionally overdub to make it feel more like a cohesive thing.
So you create like parts for these compositions or pieces by improvising. And then it's almost like a bunch of little tape recorders, right?
Mm-hmm. Totally.
Okay. And, this is after the fact, and this is like when you put it in the computer, the software for the editing. But as far as getting the sounds together, you don't use computers. You use these organic analog electronic things.
Yeah, and samplers, you know, just for rhythms and stuff. But they're not computerized. You know, it's like old hardware stuff because this was 20 years ago. So it was like these little boxes.
The more younger people have been telling me about being in these kind of like software environments like Live, Ableton Live, and Reason and stuff like this, right? They're kind of virtual studios. When you say shtick, are you saying like versus going to a gig and some guy sits at a table and presses the space bar? Which is one of the most exciting things I've ever fucking seen in my life.
Well, that was, I mean, I guess it was kind of reactionary because there were laptop jammers 20 years ago and they weren't nearly as common as they are now, but people used to always, back then people used to always make these jokes like, you know, oh, she's checking her email or he's checking his email. And I guess that, I think that we did make a conscious decision not to do that. You know, we wanted it to be really exciting. Because even though our music was, I guess, kind of far out or whatever, but we always thought of it as sort of like rock and jazz and that it was really visual, that we wanted people to see us, you know, playing and performing. And
I was just going to say it's a performance.
Yeah, we thought of ourselves as being theatrical, that it's like a theatrical band.
Yeah, I mean, yeah, compared to a recital or something, right? You're almost like vaudeville. You work in the room.
Yeah, and we did. We used to smoke, like, when we used to be able to smoke inside, I mean, we would, like, smoke like chimneys. I smoke a pipe, and Jason smokes cigarettes, but we would, like, smoke like chimneys all through the whole performance. And I used to tap dance and like amplify the floor while I was tap dancing, and we used to do all kinds of stuff.
That's got tradition going back with flamenco. The stomping was part of the percussion, along with class. Look, we're at the end of the second hour, March 12th, 2021. This is what Peter Show special guest Tom Borax. Hold tight for hour three. March 12th, 2021. It's the third hour of the Rock from Pete Rose Show.
Thank you. Thank you.
Watch for Pedro show. Start off the third hour with a biblical proportion from Leprechaun Catering. Then Mattia Cipolli with Crux. This piece was composed by Stefano Pulia, my fratello in Sonia de Manaio. And finally, Leprechaun Catering with Adult Care. And yeah, we're talking off air, people, about the idea of feet pounding on the ground, maybe the first drums, you know, in the connection with dancing and tap dancing, this, and what is music, what is rhythm, and stuff like that, and are, culturally, are we conditioned or something to do the way we do it? It's interesting about that stuff, but I guess that's one of the interesting things about music. And so, what about the rhythm? Like, you guys, you brought a drummer in, and was that...
We did.
And that, was that purposely to bring in some grooves?
Well, we always had a lot of grooves, and that's always this thing that people used to always talk to us about, because we were kind of functioning in a community where there was so much, like, avant-garde music that didn't have really obvious rhythm, and Leprechaun Catering was always sort of like a rhythm-oriented band. I mean, sometimes it would be a couple rhythms at the same time. And so, you'd like see people dancing at our shows and it looked kind of like they were going to break something because the rhythms were not quite, what wasn't like, there's maybe a little too much rhythm. So we've always been really into rhythm. And I guess I kind of think about, the fact that, thinking about, tones that, when you slow like in a synthesizer, when you slow an oscillator down really a lot to below, it just ends up sounding like percussive, like a rhythm. And I always realize, think about how audio is really just really sped up rhythm. And so I guess that Leprechaun Catering is kind of like that. And so that, I guess the theatrical element, well, the problem with the samplers, that we were doing so much sampling and using our samplers, is that when we would have beats going and sort of robotic type rhythm stuff going, that it would be too distracting while we were trying to come up with other parts. And I think that we just wanted to have somebody to handle rhythmic things so we could spend less time with samples and more time, creating parts and melodies and things. So we brought in Dan, who was in, I was in the band Snacks with at the time.
Oh yeah, this band, music we played at the beginning of the show. Okay. Mm-hmm. Now, how long did he last?
He was with us for a while. I think that we were starting to, we were starting to get a little tense about it because it was hard to record our jams, and some of the jams, I think, with the drums got just. They got too wild, and it was hard to, we were having a harder time doing what we used to do, which was, shaping the pieces after the fact into stuff. Because I think the live sound, we were recording a lot in warehouses and spaces like that, and it was really hard to isolate the speakers so that there would be tons of stuff going into the drum mics because we weren't recording in studios. We were doing sort of home setups. Didn't have really great mics for recording the drums, and you just couldn't get good drum sounds. And so there's not a ton of recordings, although there's a lot of Dan on that song Military Blunder that I sent. And that might be the only one that has a lot of Dan on it. And that's also one of the noisy, craziest ones, because that's just sort of like a real free improvised vibe that we had for those years that we played with him.
Okay. Yeah, I want to play Why Do I Leave Things on Earth?
Thank you.
people. Last music for this edition, Tom Borax, Why Do I Leave Things on Earth? Then Dayglow Exploding Super Infinite with Here Now is Fire. And finally, Tom Borax, If Could Only Be Expressed in the Ringing of Bells and Explorer Explosion of. Fuck, what? Get together. Now, these final two tunes you gave me, they're Tom Borax.
Yeah, I just did these like a month ago.
Okay, so, but is Leprechaun Caterer still an active concern?
Yeah. I mean, we just did a video set, you know, obviously because of the pandemic, we're not playing live, but we actually played together and I made a video of it that was on a, you know, kind of a video festival sort of cabaret thing, like about a week, maybe 2 weeks ago. Yeah. And then obviously I have some solo music because I'm here, you know, I there's church organ and stuff on the one song. There's a church in town that's been letting me go in there and record pipe organ.
Wow.
Mm-hmm.
That's great.
Mm-hmm.
Cause you know, those things, they're like installed, right? They'll move.
Yeah. It's the biggest instrument I've ever played. I mean, it's an honor, really. It's amazing.
You ever been to Spain? You ever been to, there's a town called Seville. Seville,
yeah.
Right? But we say Sevilla, right?
Mm-hmm.
And they got this motherfucking organ you wouldn't... I think it's the biggest cathedral in the world. It's where they got fucking... They call them colon. I guess it looks like colon if we don't pronounce it right. And he's buried there. The four big wooden king guys are holding the bone box up. But, man, I mean, there's fucking pipes the size of telephone poles in this thing. It's, like, incredible. It's next to the Alcazar and the Giralda. Incredible place because, there was a lot of money 500-600 years ago there. But anyway, you go in there, what do? You jam and then you record the stuff and bring it back to repurpose?
Yeah. I mean, I just called them on a whim because I've done stuff in that church before. It's actually the first Methodist church in the entire U.S.
Wow.
It's in downtown Baltimore. They're kind of cool. And they were doing a lot of art events there in their chapel. And I was playing the chapel organ, and the sanctuary organ's really a lot bigger and louder and crazier. And I didn't think they would let me play it. And I just kind of called them, and they let me come down there and play it. I'm by myself. And I was just jamming for the first couple times. Then I started recording, and eventually I did a streaming concert. Back in December, I just wanted to do a durational concert. So I played for 4 hours straight.
Whoa.
And just streamed it.
Wow. Well, you know, man, you put a lot of time in the scene and stuff. What about a young person getting into electronic music? What would be your advice?
Well, I'm going to maybe take I might take a slightly more reactionary approach to that because I think that the amazing thing about software, like you mentioned Ableton Live, is that you can just kind of go in and learn stuff and make stuff without knowing anything because it's intuitive and the instruments are so well designed and people are just diving in. And I think it's great. I love that about it. But I have to say that I'm constantly leaning back on my musical education. And I know a lot of people won't agree with me in that, and they won't.
No, I kind of do, because I had to come around the other way, you know, just playing with my friend, and then down the road, hey, what about this harmony stuff? And intervals, and and time, and different ways of doing time, and I mean, it's everybody's got to find their own way, right? So.
Mm-hmm.
There's some of that, but trying to say, I don't know if it's so reactionary because there's foundational stuff there, and maybe your upbringing because your pop was a teacher, so a little institutional. Mm-hmm. But then you had to find your own way. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
So maybe that's the way it is.
Yeah, I lost I sort of lost my education, and then I kind of went back to it, and that's what I mean. I went so far off that I was just. It was interesting when I wanted to have something to go back to. And, you know, it's kind of like going back to Spanish. You know, I thought I forgot Spanish. And then my wife family is Central American, and it's like, wait a minute, wait, hold on, I remember Spanish. No, I know Spanish. I didn't think I did know Spanish. You know?
Yeah. Well, you, if you don't want to lose it, you got to use it. Okay. Tom, it's been a big honor to have you aboard.
Yeah, play it's your been music. A pleasure.
And when you come out with new stuff, whether it's Tom Borax or it's new Leprechaun Catering, please come back on the show and let's listen and talk about it.
Absolutely.
Okay, thanks, brother. People, yeah. It's been the March 12th, 2021 Dishwalk Pedro Show. Keep your powder dry.